The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. It's been a long time since I gave a talk on Sundays. That's a long story. You know, we all come here. Can people hear? We all come here for different reasons, but they share a certain common quality. At one level or another, we all are fairly sure that we're going to be entering into something or dealing with something that is different from what has been our predicament in the past. We hope for a change. And realistically speaking, we have to admit that it's likely to make us feel somewhat insecure, that we didn't come here for a confirmation of convictions we already hold, or a reinforcement of practices we are already getting up to. We expect that it will be necessary for us to venture into new territory, and that it won't necessarily feel very safe. In fact, it may not even feel right. It may feel at times like something significant is being lost that we can't afford to lose. This is all pretty normal. It's not a particular predicament that any individual suffers from. It's something we all have to deal with. And really, it's not that bad. When I first came here, I figured it was going to be fun. A while later, I found, well, fun is not the worst word one could choose, but it isn't the best either. And it still isn't fun the way fun used to be. It's better. But it isn't necessarily fun. So there are difficulties. Everybody has them. They're not personal. They're not private. They're not very specialized. We share them. It's common ground. But everybody has their own particular modality of that. You know, we're not uniform. Uniformity and religious training have nothing to do with each other. Okay, this is not the place you come to become the same as everybody else. You may share a lot, you may be on very common ground, but sameness is just not part of it. Let's talk about iconography. Now, does everybody know what iconography is? Probably not everybody does. An icon is a visible form of a spiritual reality. It's something that points towards something within ourselves. But it remains on the outside. It's a visible form. You know, it's stuff. This whole room embodies a great deal of our tradition's iconography. It is, you might say, an embodiment of the tradition itself. Recently, the monks saw a bunch of photographs that had been cast into film format and thrown on a screen with Reverend Master Jiyu's commentary on them, tracing this room and this temple and the way it's made back to antecedents in Japan and China, and ultimately, I suppose, India, although she didn't cover that side of things. And she was able to trace the forms of what we have here back into the way Buddhism was being practiced in Bodhidharma's day, you know, 5th century, 6th century AD, which is a way in which she was able to at least remind us that we belong in something that is overtly legitimate. Okay, we belong to a legitimate family. But that doesn't really matter very much. I've lived with illegitimacy all my life. It's just fine. All of this stuff, the iconography of this room, which we're going to be talking about a little bit, you know, like the Buddha behind me and Kanzan over there and Achalanatha over there, the size of the room, the way it's shaped, the way the windows are. We used to have windows that had pictures on them that were displays of visions that Reverend Master Jiyu had during her big Kensho in 76. The color of the rug is iconographic. It's the blood of the Buddhas, the precepts. You're sitting on it. It's also on the cushions of the chairs. The room's full of it. But it all points towards realities that are within us. The external tradition can go up in smoke. It can be forgotten without necessarily a huge loss. It would be a loss. It wouldn't be a huge one. What actually cannot be lost is what we're made of, what we are made of, what lies within us, in our own hearts. Try to set aside the idea of mind for a minute. Mind, it doesn't matter very much. I like to use the word heart because it at least runs a little deeper than mind, even though heart doesn't necessarily mean anything denotative either. But it does point to the inside of ourselves, a region within us in which certain things are going on. There's stuff happening in there. Okay, even though it sometimes seems like nothing's happening at all, the nothing that's happening is the something that's there for the time being. And sometimes it is very visibly stuff happening. The stuff that happens within us is the origin of this room. This room, in fact, does not have its real ancestry in Japan or China. It has it inside you guys and inside me. And it constantly is arising from inside us into this room, into this temple, into the practices and the forms that we observe as trainees, like bowing and sitting. I'm going to talk a bit about sitting. I want to particularly talk about facing the wall. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. The real thing's inside you. It's already in there. It's not a destination to which you are traveling. It's already there. It was there before you were born. It's the reason you bothered to be born in the first place, because you thought it would be fun. And it turned out to be, well, it was okay for a while, wasn't it? And it's still not so bad, because you can laugh, right? It's not so bad. Somebody or other recently told me, or Master Hario, quoting something he found on the net from a Greek philosopher of Roman times, who said, a person who can laugh at themselves will never run out of have something to laugh at. And will enjoy all the rest of his days. That's it, man. Where was I? Yeah. So it arises from within us. This is what we take refuge in. So long as the mind insists on being in charge, it has a habit of looking outwards at stuff, of following the path of the eyeballs to outside objects. It pays attention to things that the sensory organs hear, smell, touch, and think, because thought is recognized as an organ of perception in Buddhism. We say there are six senses, not five. So the mind has a habit of looking outwards. That's just fine. It's what it does for a living, and it does it pretty well. You know, if you want to paint the wall blue, it pays to know what blue looks like and to be able to go down to Ace Hardware and pick which particular shade you want and then apply it to the wall. You need a mind to do it with. So it's okay. It's not an aberration. But it becomes a difficulty if we choose to follow the path of mind and pretend that we're hollow on the inside and that there's nothing there. Because although there's a vast open space within us, it's not actually empty, the stuff in there. And I don't mean negative stuff necessarily. I don't mean karmic material. I mean stuff that's a lot older than karma. It has no age at all. It's just the way galaxies are built. You know, they revolve. Same as we do when we're doing offering incense for today's ceremony. It's been happening an awfully long time. There are certain elements of our iconography that I want to dwell upon. My purpose is fairly simple, really, to encourage you to continue training no matter what. Let's deal with the purpose for just a minute, and then we'll come back to it, and then I'll start talking about the iconography again. Boredom is a problem for the mind. Boredom is not a problem for the heart. For the heart that's within you, boredom is a ridiculous idea. It just isn't there. But the mind gets bored. The mind is hungry. It gets lonely. It gets frustrated. It gets upset. And it pursues alternatives, options. Quick fixes, ways in which we might feel better. The mind is always looking for a way to feel better. It tends to follow rhythms in doing so. You know, we resort to sleep all too often. We resort to sleep not because we need to sleep, but because we want to get away from being awake. You know, being awake is, well, by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, it isn't quite a drag yet, but it's getting there, okay? So you have a bite to eat at mealtime. Maybe you go out to dinner and have something fancy. That cheers you up, isn't it? And then after that, well, digestion sets in, and things kind of start heading downhill. And it's really good to see the business side of a pillow, isn't it? It's escape. Of course, where you're escaping to is another story. But so often we go to sleep to escape. So often we wake up in the morning to escape from the night before. Because they're, you know, like Hamlet thought, you know, perchance to dream. Sleep isn't all it's cracked up to be, is it? There's a lot of stuff in sleep. A lot of it can be very sweet, and a lot of it can be a nightmare. So, The mind spends so much time trying to get away from the distress. You know, we teach that there is suffering. You don't need to be taught that there is suffering, do you? Okay. I can remember when I was a kid, 14, 15, I would not have tolerated that statement. Because, not because life looked so good, but because I was greedy for life. You know, I was ambitious to experience everything. Adventure was what I was, you know, it's what I ate my meals for. There wasn't anything else worth dickering with as far as I was concerned. And I wouldn't have tolerated some old buzzard, 68 years old, sitting in a chair dressed in strange clothes, insisting that actually what I was doing was suffering. No, I wouldn't have put up with it. So I didn't put up with it. I resisted church with great intensity. I'd come home, wander home from the sheer boredom of church. And out there I would see the ocean, because I lived in New Zealand. And the sun might be shining on a nice, warmish spring day. I'd start to run. I'd get home in a hurry, change into clothes that actually worked, and I'd head to the beach. And I wouldn't do that now, but I did it then. And yet, the burden wouldn't go away. I guess part of the most disappointing element in all of this was the vision of girls. The damn things wouldn't go away. Okay? I could be out there on a glorious day, 5 miles from land, and I'd still be thinking about bloody women. And, you know, this starts to get you down after a while. And you begin to have very reasonable doubts about one's ability to continue. Darkness starts to close in. It gets darker. By the time I was in my 20s, it was quite dark. I was still ambitious because I still thought there was a way out somewhere, but it was getting dark. And then I wound up here. So we have a lot of trouble. If I could persuade you, urge you to sit with the trouble. Don't try to fix it. Don't try to find a way around it. But just sit in front of the trouble. Then this talk would be worthwhile. I'm going to talk about some details about this, and maybe the details are worthwhile too. But that's the guts of the matter. Just to be patient enough to proceed, courageous enough to keep going. To set aside the critical mind a little, because the critical mind would like to understand, to see the reasons, to see the reasonable expectations, to see what lies ahead, to see, consider whether it's going to be worthwhile or not. That's the critical mind's function, to determine whether an action is worth undertaking on the basis of anticipated product. And that won't quite work for you now, because the darkness doesn't have a visible horizon yet. The darkness is good for you, incidentally. The patience of suffering itself is the same as your patience in sitting in front of it. It's as strong as you are as strong as it is. Eventually, you will be the same and everything will be fine because there will be harmony. But you will never defeat it. And actually, it will never defeat you. So you sit in front of it. You sit there. This is why we sit facing a wall. not to observe the paintwork, but to sit in front of the wall that is within us. Of getting back to the iconography, of all of the elements of our Buddhist iconography, which is an extensive field. You go to our library and look up all of the books that are full of Buddhist iconography. It is enormous. It is, there's a lot of stuff. But the one icon that remains, it's there waiting for you every morning when you go to meditation. It's the wall. And in the evening when you meditate, there it is. It's the wall. And all the rest of the time in between, when you're living daily life and when you're trying to sleep at night, there it is. It isn't a painted surface anymore. Instead, it's the obstacles. And of course, they're movable obstacles. They shift around. They look like a kind of a living zone of trouble, stuff, shifting cloud. It's still a wall. We speak of the wall that's within us. And we speak of a gate in that wall. There's a way through. The wall is the element of our iconography that we live with day in, day out, as individuals. We don't have to see it in a vision. We don't have to hear the voice of God telling us about it. There it is. It's the wall. Master Jiyu used to tell us of a disciple she had in Japan who sat down, I think she ordained him, who sat down to do his first meditation retreat, and on about day four, he got totally pissed off and stuck his fist through the sheetrock. He was sitting in front of the wall, and he just got mad, and he punched. He put a hole in the wall. This isn't the way to go, okay? You just have to fix the hole and possibly get a Band-Aid. It's not, violence is not a solution to anything here. Patience is, but violence is not. And you cannot react to suffering and to the wall by striking out. Not by striking at anything. All too often, we strike at other things that seem smaller than the wall, like our children or something. We strike there. It's supposed to make us feel better, never does. We pick victims smaller than our own size. But he struck the wall. It happens occasionally. Just approaching the iconography from a slightly different angle, and yet to talk about the same thing. Over there, we have a Chalanatha. Okay, that shrine. Over here, we have Kanzeon. Let's start with Kanzeon. Kanzeon is a very pretty, well-dressed, sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant lady who doesn't quite look like your mother, but looks a little bit like Leave It to Beaver's mother, all right? It's a very American form, and it's precisely what Rev. Master Jiyu wanted at the time, to get away from the Japanese and the Chinese, to make it clear that we were Americans and we could deal with the iconography in an American form. It's very beautiful. It's very colorful. I was here when River Master Mok again painted that. And I was working in the maintenance building all of the time that she was painting it. She was painting it in one of the upstairs rooms, and we would talk quite a lot about the gold in particular. The gold was a lot of work. It's real gold, gold leaf. And I could see that some of the icons, particularly from the Russian tradition that she was working from, not because she wanted that particular shape, but because she wanted that particular feeling. If you look at it for long enough, you realize it's very similar to the very best work that came out of the Disney studios, way back in the days of Cinderella and Snow White. It has lines rather than shadows. And a lot of the old iconography in Christian Europe is very much the same. And spiritual vision often is very much the same. If you happen to see a person, it has line forms, clear colors. And you notice she doesn't have any shadows at all. There are shadows in him. That's a different story. There are no shadows over here, except on the ocean. The waves at the bottom, which is samsara, the suffering, the wall. It casts a shadow on itself. But she doesn't cast a shadow on it. Compassion, loving kindness. It makes us feel very good. It makes others feel good. It creates community in a world that urgently needs one. It creates community here, and we urgently need one. It creates harmony. It creates a sense of loveliness and an appreciation for good painting. It doesn't appear before us all the time. In fact, only for very short times. Otherwise, we would get spoiled. We would become dependent and weak. And we would cease to be certain that she was inside us instead of out there. Because she's inside us, you know. I mean, she's a picture on the wall right there. But as I said before, all of the iconography in this room actually only points to a body of iconography that's within you. She's already within you. You don't have to go searching for her. She's there already. If the need arises, she will appear one way or another, even though you may not recognize it when it comes. Now, like I said before, she comes and goes. She doesn't stay for very long. She can be an enormous relief at times of abject trouble. And if you take refuge in compassion in your own inward life rather than the externals, and in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, if you take the refuges, then it's an awful lot easier for her to help you. She'll help you anyway, but it's hard unless you help her out by being willing to turn in her direction. Now, over here we have Achalanatha. Let me say right from the beginning that Achalanatha, on his forehead, right around here, is, I think he does in that picture, but anyway, he is supposed to have an image of Kanzeon on his forehead. He is, in fact, Kanzeon's brother, you might say. Apparently it's traditional for a Buddha hall to have the Buddha, the golden fellow behind me, on the altar in the center with the Kanzeon shrine on one side and the Achalanatha shrine on the other. They all go together. Achalanatha is the one who offers you intense suffering. He offers you the wall, the body of shadows and ugliness, darkness and fire, smoke and rock, the stuff that hurts. He offers you that. Without it, you wouldn't stand a chance. Distraction, well, no, let's not call it distraction. Without it, you wouldn't bother. I mean, they say the problem with the devas, you know, the gods in heaven, is that they don't have enough of a Chalanatha to keep them on the track. So basically they lapse into dependence upon their chronic drug-induced cheerfulness. As Ernest Hemingway said in one of his very best short stories, life is the opiate of the people. You know, Marx said that of religion, right? Well, Hemingway worked through a number of options and came to the conclusion that life is the opiate of the people. I think he's right. If you depend upon external life, on all of the ambition and the lust for the pleasantness of things, that's a drug trip. And the Chalanatha's business is to put you into cold turkey. Suffering is the suffering of withdrawal and of the encounter with the cause of the need for withdrawal. He's very ugly. He has blue skin. His eyes look in two different directions and his teeth stick out over the lips of his mouth. He looks a little crazy, the way suffering always does. He offers the tools that lead to liberation, the sword that cuts through delusion, and a rope, which is the rope of self-restraint. Recognizing that if you want to avoid hell, then you have to avoid heaven first. You get stuck on the drug of heaven, and hell is inevitable. It's a rhythm, a circuitous rhythm that cannot be broken. You enter at one point, you're in it. The only way out is to abandon the whole thing. You can't get heaven and get rid of the hell. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. It will never work that way. This is one of the most difficult things to believe, that heaven is impossible unless hell is also rendered impossible. Then you stand a chance. You notice that a Chalanatha has shadows and that the light that shines on him is a kind of eerie white light and you don't know where it's coming from, but somewhere above. He sits on rock. He's surrounded by smoke and there's a great blossom of fire just behind him. I met a Chalanatha one time. The real one, on the inside. You all do, but I met him face to face. Well, no, it wasn't face to face. He was very big. All I could see up to was just below his knees. He was purple more than he was blue. He delivered upon me suffering that cannot be described. It's completely off the charts. The worst of it was that I knew I caused it. He just handed it to me. And he also made available his twin over here as the way to cure the suffering. If I was willing to take refuge, and believe me, I was, willing to take refuge in compassion, the suffering stopped instantly. It was like turning off a black light. But it was very tiring. God, it was exhausting. The amount of concentration that was required to make that commitment to compassion. And so I backed off. Suffering came back. I was caught between a rock and a hard place. Either I wear myself to death with effort in a matter of minutes, or there was this suffering. I don't mean, you know, anxiety about the fact that I've lost my pink stuffed doggy or something. I don't mean the kind of loneliness that comes from whatever. I mean suffering that has no shape. It doesn't even qualify as burning or cold. You know, the typical descriptions of hell as fire and ice are trivial compared with this. So I'd go back to Kanzaion again. Eventually, he let me off the hook. It, I guess, lasted 30 seconds. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. I pray with all my heart that it will happen to all of you. Of course, you don't pray for that. Okay? And I must admit, I don't exactly spend a lot of time praying for it to happen to me again either. But that is a bit of a problem with cynicism. Okay? The fact is, this is the best thing in the world. It's also the worst thing in the world, but that's bearable. Well, actually, no, it's not. But it fits. It fits in the pattern of things, which is what iconography is. It's a pattern of things. It's a description on the outside, and it's a fact on the inside. Which is the thing about the wall and about suffering in general, and about what River Master Jiu used to call going in and out. There's him and there's her. There's always both of them. And you go backwards and forwards. On a daily basis, we do this. There are bad patches, and then there's relief. And there are good patches, and then there's hard stuff again. And then there's relief. Backwards and forwards. You look at this for long enough, you begin to find that it has a definite rhythm. Not a random rhythm, not something that in which one is causing the other. It's not a stimulus and response pattern at all. It's not engendered by fear. It's not engendered by self-consciousness or anxiety. It's a fact. It actually happens, and happens for reasons that are beyond you and your personality. It doesn't happen because you have karma. It happens because it happens. Backwards and forwards. Often we have a choice to take refuge in her in order to deal with what he offers us. And that's fine. Okay? We are participants in this process. We are not just simply there receiving something that is handed to us all the time. We're participants, okay? Active participants. If there were no relief, we would die very quickly and experience unbelievable despair. Despair that would grow as the awareness of suffering grows over the years. If there were no suffering, we would never find the path, we would never bother to find the path, and we would never bother to walk along it. And the Buddha would wait for us in vain. We would never turn up. So we go backwards and forwards. We go in and out, always becoming Buddha. It's written on River Master Jiu's stupa, on the south-facing face of the stupa. Going in and out, always becoming Buddha. It seems to be most of the time like this. Now, I used to ask myself, I still do once in a while, whether pure relief from suffering exists, whether there is a place where suffering is simply gone for good and never returns. And there is. But you can't afford to think about that too much. Unfortunately, in Buddhism, when we are teaching, we have a tendency to spout off about nirvana and no self. It's our favorite, no self. There is never no self until you get there. You are not entitled to speak of no self until you are fully aware of no self. It just isn't wise. So long as you have anything that you could call a self, be content with it and face it the way you face the wall. Don't look for something that the books talk about, but which isn't there in front of you. Look at what's in front of you. Never mind the no self stuff. Dogen said, you can make a huge argument about self and no self, and all of it is a waste of time. The same is true of the perfection of no suffering. Don't try to cut to the chase. Don't try to take a shortcut. There are no shortcuts. And it is a distraction to entertain fantasies about what it might be like when your suffering has gone altogether. This is vain and a waste of time and a loss of opportunities and an insult to Achalanatha. Is trying to help. You may not like him, but he's trying to help. Turning away from him and daydreaming about the end of the universe. Don't do that. So patience. It's what Shakyamuni used to say was the greatest asceticism. And it's true. Just sitting. In Japanese, they called it shikantaza. It means just sitting. It doesn't mean sitting on ho-hum, only sitting, who really cares about it, all you're doing is sitting. It's not like that at all. It's just in the sense of don't do anything else as well. If you sit and try to work on yourself, you're missing the point. If you sit and try to understand, you miss the point. If you sit and try to be happy, you miss the point, but it's a little better. Just sit. It's appallingly difficult to believe. The masters, the old Chinese masters, used to go on and on about this to disciples who would go on and on saying the old buzzard didn't know what he was talking about, basically. That it can't be that way. You've got to do something. And the teacher would just go on saying, if you do something, you're just missing the point. We talk a lot about trust. This is trust. Trust the doing nothing is the best thing. It doesn't mean being passive. It doesn't mean just sitting there and taking it as though it was being handed out to you, either suffering or joy. You can't just sit there and wait for the sun to shine or work. Sit there and don't wait for the sun to shine. Don't wait. This is why they say there is no sun. Not because there is no sun, but because there bloody well better be no sun while you're doing this, because you can't afford the extra weight. If you're hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, You don't take heavy toys with you. You can't tolerate the weight. The same's true with this. You're hiking the Eightfold Path. Don't take stuff with you. You can't handle the extra weight. You can't bear the burden of nirvana. It's too damn heavy. Let it go. Just sit there. Keep your eyes open. Keep your back straight. And this is where the iconography helps again. You see the Buddha behind me has his back straight. He has his eyes open. You don't do that. It's not, this is where iconography becomes seriously interesting, where the iconography actually begins to manifest as actions performed in your body. It's what we call mudras, which is an old Sanskrit word, I believe. It means meaningful gesture, spiritually significant gesture or posture or behavior or act or position of the hands or legs or body. Keep your eyes open. It matters. There will be times when you need to keep your eyes shut. You'll find out about that eventually when the time comes, but don't count on it. Keep your eyes open. It's not because you're watching for something. Just keep their bloody eyes open. I don't know why. I don't care why. Just keep your eyes open. And keep your back as straight as you can. Now, I understand that people who have back trouble of various kinds, exhaustion problems, pains and this, that, and the other thing. We have these black chairs that we use. You notice that? Okay, well, there's no straight back in a black chair. That's okay, too. You go through the options from the one you begin with and you find, okay, I can't do that. I try, it hurts too much. So you move to the next. And that doesn't work either. Okay. You move to the next. Eventually, you graduate to the black chair, perhaps. Or as Reverend Master Jiyu said, sometimes you lie in what she called corpse pose, lying flat on your back. That's okay if you have to. It is not okay if you just choose to. You've got to do your best. Picking what seems to be the most comfortable, the least demanding, the one that in complicated ways makes you feel more comfortable. Don't do that. Push a little bit. Pushing is not what meditation is really about, but you should press yourself to be as close to the ideal as possible. And yet not allowing yourself to enter so closely to the ideal that it burns you. You know, we sing in the scripture about a giant fireball, never put yourself too close or too far away. Well, that applies to a lot of things, but in particular it applies to the so-called ideal. The perfect way of doing things, not too close, not too far away. Don't try to be ideal. It doesn't work. You just hurt yourself. And just sit there. You find that you can actually let go of your mind. And when you let go of your mind, it's not as though you stop thinking. It's that it actually dissolves. And the thoughts go on. It is possible to think and have no mind. It is possible to live and not breathe. It's possible to be aware and have no consciousness. This is standard Buddhist teaching. It's not just Chosei talking weird. Okay, this is actually in the books. Just sit there and you'll find that you can let go of your mind. And then the resistance begins to disappear. And we begin to actually taste liberation, which is what we came for. We didn't come here to reinforce our habits. We came for liberation. And it is available. It's just a hard road, but it's okay. If it were not hard, it would not be a road at all, and there would be no way. And that's about all I have to say today. Thank you very much.